when he was crossing the road, he looked up towards right and left, and in the meantime, his eyes went on to two ladies who were not covering their heads
properly
with the hijab.
Right.
And it was before the revolution. The story is before the revolution.
Right.
At that time, you know that the people from Europe used to come for entertainment to Iran. So how they were, you can imagine, half-naked ladies. So accidentally, his eyes went towards them. And it was the first sight. And then he immediately
lowered
his gaze, and then he went towards the hospital. When he entered the room, his father turned his face away from him. And he said to him, "Did I not say to you to not to lift your eyes?"
Right.
And then he understood that what I have seen, he can see in me.
On his face.
On his face.
We have many
his
stories
soul,
of such things.
Yes, his soul has got the same picture. So he
it
can
has
see
been
it
tainted.
In his, so basically, the eyes are the... we need to be very much careful about our eyes. That these eyes are making our, you know, shape that we're going to have in the... hereafter.
Right.
So we need to be very much careful.
So the eyes are actually the weakest barrier we have against sins then.
And the major thing that shapes you, that
right.
make your the shape of the spirit or soul that we have.
Right. So now we know the importance of the eyes and how easy it is to commit sins with them. How do we stop from committing such sins? Like, you cannot tell us to in a big urban city with cars and traffic lights and so much traffic and places where you can easily get into an accident, or when you're driving your car, you cannot lower your gaze always. So what are we supposed to do here?
Well, obviously, first thing is you need to be strong enough that you can control yourself.
The will.
Number two, try to, you know, obviously we are outside, we are working, we are at job, but after that, try to look at the things which are referred, you know, for the eyes, looking at the Mus'haf of Qur'an, reading Qur'an from there, trying to read the translation, understand what Qur'an says. These things helps us. Even at the time when there is a break, obviously you can just open your mobile and look at the verses of the Qur'an.
Right.
When you're at home, try to be careful, obviously, you know, when we have gatherings, the family gatherings or the friends gatherings, yes,
right.
There we can obviously lower our gaze and do not look up. You can lower your eyes. You
right.
can be very much careful. When we are alone, mobile phones, obviously, every program is not recommended to see. Yeah.
Right.
One thing that we have, like, you know, nowadays, that whenever it's a weekend, everyone shouts for movie night.
Right, yeah. Yes, of course.
A movie night.
Naturally.
This movie that you're watching, this is not what's going to be, you know, what's going to purify you. It's not going to purify you. You should go towards something that purifies you, which gives you peace, the inner peace. Obviously,
right.
we are after inner peace. And that's in obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Obviously, all these things that I'm saying, no one should think that it's for the others, it's for myself and the others as well. First,
right.
we need to obviously apply all these things on our own selves before we advise someone else. Otherwise, you know, these wordings or the things that we say, they will not have any effect upon the others. So this is for all of us that in the Quran also, we have many times where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, ittaqullah, be God-bearing. Be
right.
God-weary.
Be pious.
So be
right.
pious or God-weary. So we need to be God-weary, and we need to think that the things in which there is a disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we should get away from it. And the things that are
right.
in accordance to the obedience of Allah, we should perform them, inshallah.
Say just one final short question. When we are walking about, or in any case, in any circumstance, sometimes our eyes fall upon something that we are not supposed to see, and then we avert our gaze. Does our narrations say that even this gaze, is that also considered a sin? Or is that just a challenge of life?
Well, for it, you need to refer to the books of jurisprudence.
Right.
You know, the Tawzi'ul Masail, generally we call the book of law. And the Maraji or the Mujtahideen, they have answered this question. Some of them, like Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Khamenei, they all have answered this question. If the site was without any intention, so the first site for the first movement, until you realize that this is a sin or I should not look at such thing,
right,
and you immediately lower your gaze or lower your eyes, so this is not considered as a sin. Obviously, you know, Islam is not a religion of beating and punishing the people. Right. There are ways to get out. Obviously, yes, there are some effects, we call it takwini, which is on our existence. But still, such things are not considered as a sin. But if second time someone intentionally look at the same place, obviously this intention, the inner intention is very important, that when you're looking at something, what's your intention? Are you doing it without having a control or accidentally or no? You're doing it purposely with intentions.
Right.
So that's the main criteria here.
Dear Sayyid, I thank you yet again for your very valuable and insightful knowledge. I also thank you to your listeners for tuning in. This has been your host, Musa Al-Bahali, and this has been your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن علي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي تهران
روباشافيت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
رشا سغلام اسطنبول
سيد امين عالمي كابول
شهان بات Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Soon after Prime Minister Modi won a landslide victory in the 2014 general elections, like other leaders, he wouldn't shy away from talking about the spirit of democracy. The Prime Minister said democracy will sustain only by freedom of speech and expression. But in Modi's New India, it looks like a different story altogether. Journalists in the world's largest democracy are caught in a limbo, not just about how to report, but also what to report. Many fear for personal safety, right to report the facts, while others are intimidated, harassed, and even charged under draconian and sedition laws. Some are threatened aggressively. A poignant case is that of Indian journalist Neha Dixit, who revealed a horrifying ordeal while receiving a prestigious International Press Freedom Award.
The last couple of years have been about endless follow-up and legal cases, death threats and rape threats, complete with descriptions of how it should be conducted on my body. They've also been about being held physically hostage by right-wing Hindu fundamentalists while reporting.
Nevertheless, the show goes on while tuning in to watch your favorite prime time, where abuses, yelling, personal attacks, and at times cracking laughter is a routine. According to New York-based hybrid research and journalism organization, The Police Project, 256 reports of violence against journalists in India were recorded from May 2019 till August 2021. Media experts say press freedom has further diminished after the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP. Recent years have seen a dramatic rise in violence against journalists while they were covering stories on different issues. Social media is also becoming a tool for trolling and threatening not just journalists, but anyone. Many renowned journalists and media personalities have now shifted their platforms in the pursuit of truth and perhaps the other way of the narrative. Rather than appearing on big platforms, they have resorted to social media as an easy tool to put forth their side of the stories.
There is a culture which is not limited to one political party or a particular government, but there's a culture now that has been developed where people who kind of bring out inconvenient truths are questioned.
Experts say after the emergence of BJP in India, there is a sense of polarized environment where journalists find themselves more divided, while many are still confused if it's all about patronizing the popular rather than speaking about the unpopular. But the never-ending or perhaps unwanted debates find more space in Indian media platforms rather than the ones that makes difference. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Europe's vaccine rollout got off to a rocky start at the end of 2020, and now, almost a year later, even distribution across the bloc has not been achieved. In Romania, only 30% of the population is vaccinated. Now it's in the grips of its most deadly wave, with all intensive care beds full and patients being turned away. In Germany, 65% of the population are double jabbed. But some regions are going into lockdown again, and those refusing the jab are being barred from indoor spaces. And in Britain, 67% of the population is double jabbed, and 8 million people have received booster jabs. Nonetheless, with social distancing laws scrapped, numbers are skyrocketing. While some countries are still struggling to give everyone a first and second dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, others are rolling out booster jabs. And the blame game is in full swing. Governments are slamming vaccine hesitancy and lack social distancing, while citizens across Europe are saying they just don't trust the people in charge. The very same leaders who promised poorer nations their fair share of vaccines, but have not delivered. The World Health Organization has slammed the likes of Britain and Israel for rolling out booster shots, while the majority of poor countries haven't even vaccinated their most vulnerable.
The clue is in the name, it's a pandemic. And until everybody is vaccinated and everybody is safe, then nobody, theoretically, is safe. And we are seeing what's been called vaccine nationalism, vaccine apartheid. And this is part of Western hegemony, Western hegemonic values, a sense of Western exceptionalism, that poor countries, they can wither on the vine as long as we've got enough vaccines. And it's a case in point that Western countries have far more their vaccines in store than what they really need. But there's a reluctance to give out these vaccines, one, because there's a selfishness that is part and parcel of Western society and Western ideology, but also, I think, a sense that Big Pharma wants to start making a profit from these vaccines and is not minded to give them out for free or at cost, as they were to Western countries and Western governments. It's all about power, it's all about imperialism, and it's sowing dragon's teeth in a time of pandemic.
Vaccine apartheid is to no one's benefit. It undermines a global recovery and allows more virulent virus variants to appear. Scientists warn waning immunity from vaccinations could mean many more people across Europe getting sick and dying this winter. Bianca Rahimi, London.
To fish or not to fish, at the center of an escalating row between France and Britain, after France seized one British trawler and fined another for not playing by the new rules.
The UK used to be part of the EU Common Fisheries Policy that allowed all European vessels equal access to these waters. But after Brexit, everything changed. Now both the EU and UK vessels have to have licenses to be able to fish in each other's territorial waters. And not only that, they have to prove that they have done so in the past.
To make things more complicated, the self-governing British territories of Jersey and Guernsey in the Channel Islands issue their own licenses. France accuses the UK of granting a small number of licenses it's entitled to. Britain denies that.
The French have behaved unfairly. You know, it's not within the terms of the trade deal. And if somebody behaves unfairly in a trade deal, you are entitled to take action against them and seek some compensatory measures.
But why is this happening now? In France, it might have something to do with an upcoming election.
There is an election coming up, and therefore President Macron would like to wrap himself in the flag, and particularly if it's an opportunity of actually having a go at the British. But also there's an issue that actually, in terms of a broader EU sense, that actually want to make sure that Britain isn't seen to be benefiting by leaving the Union.
And on this side of the channel, it's all about reminding British voters of the perks of Brexit.
The British Prime Minister, Johnson, is trying to make sure that he is seen to be strong, standing up against the French, and that Brexit is being a success. The fishing industry as a part of the economy is tiny in Britain, but it's a very emotional issue. And of course there he said he would be standing up and protecting the fishing industry, and frankly he hasn't been doing so.
The French have threatened to prevent British vessels from docking at their ports if the issue isn't resolved soon, against Britain's threats of legal action. For now, though, the two sides seem to have hit the pause button on tit-for-tat measures. Key talks are set for later this week, with experts saying the risk of further escalation remains. Saeed Pariza, Dover, United Kingdom.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip mark the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They also expressed their anger towards the British government and its continued support to the Israeli regime. In 1917, then-British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his declaration giving Zionists the permission to usurp Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration led to the displacement of the indigenous Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Hamas movement vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Palestinian people are still suffering from the repercussions of the ill-fated Balfour Declaration, which created a Zionist entity on holy Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration will be trampled upon by the Palestinian people. After 104 years, we maintain that all form of resistance will be used to liberate all of the historic land of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees, who make up most of Gaza's population, demanded compensation from the British government for the pain and suffering for more than seven decades.
We want to liberate the land of Palestine and return to the towns and villages from which we were expelled. The Zionists have no rights here and have no place in our land.
The United Kingdom, along with the United States, have been the strongest supporters of the Israeli regime. Senior Palestinian officials demanded that the British government must compensate Palestinians for the grave pain and loss.
Britain has started our misery, and the United States has taken it upon itself to continue this injustice by supporting the Zionist occupation and giving it the green light to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Both Britain and the United States have been making attempts to turn the Israeli regime into a military superpower.
104 years on, the Balfour Declaration continues to plague all aspects of life for Palestinians.
The Balfour Declaration is considered by most Palestinians as the root cause of their suffering under the Israeli occupation. They also blame England for their plight. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
People in the Gaza Strip held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip to express solidarity with Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails who are on hunger strike in protest to their harsh conditions. Seven Palestinian inmates are in a critical condition due to their hunger strike against the illegal administrative detention practiced against them.
Palestinian inmates have resorted to hunger strike as their last means to defend their rights. Israel's illegal administrative detention must come to an end. We are here to call human rights organizations to pressurize Israel into ending the illegal policy.
In a press conference held during the demonstration, the participants warned against the deteriorating health condition of the prisoners in Israeli jails.
We are here to show our solidarity with our brothers in Israeli jails. To this end, we have gone on a hunger strike to send this message to our brothers that they are not alone in their struggle against Israel. We won't sit back and are ready to pay the price for defending our rights.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have witnessed heightened pressure over the past years. There are reportedly about 5,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons, with a great number of them remaining in jail without any charge.
Supporting our inmates are among our top priorities. We feel duty-bound to defend our brothers with all possible means. To this end, we have organized a number of events to highlight the plight of Palestinian inmates inside Israeli jails.
Israeli authorities keep Palestinian inmates under harsh conditions, from lacking proper hygienic standards to systematic torture. Several Palestinian detainees have been on their hunger strike inside Israeli jails for more than 100 days, protesting their arrest with no charge and the harsh prison conditions. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have begun the hunger strike in solidarity with the prisoners whose lives are at risk. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The 2nd of November is remembered by Palestinians as a disastrous date in history. It's the 104th anniversary of the so-called Balfour Declaration that pledged on behalf of Britain in 1917 a homeland for the Jewish people in historic Palestine, as every year the Palestinian flag was flown at half-mast mourning this date. Palestinians say the declaration was the first official recognition of the Zionist project by a world power, leading to widespread legitimization of the cause and the eventual establishment of Israel.
Balfour Declaration was one of the worst conspiracies against the Palestinian people. It aimed at depriving us from our right to our homeland, depriving us from our right to have our state, our own state. And it has led to a very severe disaster, which is the ethnic cleansing of about 70% of the Palestinian people in 1948.
The Palestinians are demanding the United Kingdom to apologize for the declaration, and they blame Britain for helping Israel in its occupation of Palestinian territory. But it seems this apology won't happen, Palestinians say, as more world countries harm Palestinians, especially after former U.S. President Donald Trump invented the so-called deal of the century that envisions the Israeli annexation of large swaths of the occupied West Bank. Even after 1 year of his departure, current U.S. President Joe Biden is weak to be able to change Trump's promises to Israel.
Many colonial countries have agreed together to harm the Palestinians and their cause. But our people are still steadfast on our land and dissolve the conspiracies. Trump tried through the so-called deal of the century, first to allow Israel annex the West Bank to prevent a Palestinian state on the 1967 lines with its capital Al-Quds, and never reaching a resolution on the refugees problem. The UK helped Jewish gangs to have a state on our land, U.S. is supporting them up until the moment.
Palestinians say that the Balfour Declaration has always served as a reminder of the suffering of Palestinians during the decades of Israeli occupation, colonialism, and Judaization.
It has been over a century since the notorious Balfour Declaration. Palestinians today warn that the U.S. support of Israeli encroachment into Palestinian territory is as dangerous as Britain's Balfour Declaration and is definitely helping Israel to prolong its occupation and annex Palestinian land. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
With the socio-economic crisis deepening in Lebanon, the Saudi regime is not making things any easier. Riyadh's reaction to comments by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi, who had decried the Saudi war on Yemen, is a stick being used against the Lebanese government. The main question is, will he step down?
Concerning Mr. Kordahi, it is obvious now that he is not going to resign because he is not resembling himself. He is resembling a huge national bloc that is backing him because it's a matter of the Lebanese dignity here. We are not going to let the Saudis succeed in their blackmailing moves against Lebanon.
But analysts believe the Saudi Crown Prince is trying to get concessions from Lebanon in return for funding the economic reform plan.
Saudi Crown Prince is trying to make use of the economic crisis taking place in Lebanon to put pressure on the Lebanese to make some concessions regarding his influence inside Lebanon. And here there is some kind of intersection between the Saudis and the Israelis because the target is the resistance in Lebanon.
Lebanese Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib told Agence France-Presse that he had invited the Saudis to the negotiating table in a bid to solve all the outstanding problems. Saudi Arabia is an Arab country, he said, which has historic brotherly ties with Lebanon, but then severed diplomatic ties without holding any talks. Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati is also holding talks with other Arab states in COP20 in Glasgow to see whether the diplomatic row can be eased. Now, observers say it all has to do with how the Americans deal with the Saudis.
The main issue is between Riyadh and Washington. Once the situation between Washington and Riyadh is solved, I think the crisis will be solved in Lebanon. And the pressure the Saudis are exerting on Lebanon is going to soften. But up till now, it seems that Mikati having the backing of Washington and Paris, because, as I said, they both want this government to remain.
While the crisis resulting from Minister Kordahi's statements remains high, the Saudis themselves have declared that their campaign against Lebanon is a much bigger issue. Their ultimate goal in the last couple of decades seemed to have been detaching Hezbollah from the Lebanese political scene. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
As Afghanistan is struggling with a wide range of problems, the country's officials warn against the plots hatched by Afghanistan's enemies to wreak further havoc on it. In a conference in the capital, Kabul, Taliban's acting minister of enjoining good and forbidding wrong said that discord has been a big threat to Muslim world even from the very beginning of Islam, adding that one of Afghanistan invaders' goals has been to sow sedition among different Muslim sects in the country.
During the invasion years, the enemies did whatever they wanted in our country. One of their goals was to deepen the differences among our people. This conspiracy has always been used against Muslims throughout history. And if we don't remain united, our enemies will again take control of Afghanistan.
During the conference, Muslim scholars stressed the need for solidarity and tolerance. They added that if Muslims stay aware and united, no one can invade their soil or they don't need to beg foreigners.
Muslim unity should not remain in slogans. People and nations should practically implement it. Islamic governments are obliged to bring Muslims together. Today's critical situation in our country is deeply rooted in the discord created by the Western countries.
We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime are trying to weaken Muslims. Westerners are afraid of the spread of Islam. To stop its progress, they have already hatched various plots, including the formation of Takfiri groups.
After taking power, the Taliban reached to different groups and ethnicities and assured them of protecting their rights and providing a safe haven for all Afghans. But as observers say, it remains to be seen what the future holds for the country. Muslim scholars hope that the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan paves the way for solidarity and tolerance in the country. At the same time, they warn of divisive plot by Islam's enemies. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Last week, the Biden administration said that it is considering giving $450,000 per person to immigrants separated at the border. However, there are still 1,727 children yet to be reunited with their families, representing 33% of all those identified as separated from their parents by DHS under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, a clear violation of human rights.
Essentially due to the racism on the part of the United States and how they resolve the problem. So, for example, the border crisis from Canada is very differently handled than the one that happens from the U.S.-Mexico border. And there's also this lack of dignity rights that are afforded those who are from the global south in terms of how they want to seek entry into the United States.
Many experts agree that the United States has failed to help Latin America countries to have strong, transparent public institutions with less corruption. Another problem is that some Central American countries have the highest rates of poverty and violence in Latin America, which requires greater investment to create jobs and combat gangs that terrorize Central Americans who end up fleeing to the U.S.
I believe what hinders that relations of the United States with their southern neighbors is a history of bad relations, right? Even if you want to build up good relations now, relations that better the conditions in those countries so that these people do not need to emigrate from their countries.
More than 60% of immigrants have resided in this country for more than a decade and have more than 4 million children born in the United States. Despite all discriminations and difficulties imposed by different governments, they are the backbone of the agriculture, construction, and hospitality sectors, representing 5% of the workforce. If the promises of the United States to make more than three times as many people as full citizens comes to fruition, this could be open the door to one of the most important demographic changes in modern American history. By pulling millions of Latin immigrants out of the shadows and as potential voters. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Curvello.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Limelight.
Corporate influence and corruption defines American politics. No wonder most think the country is headed in the wrong direction. We now present you an article written jointly by David Sirota and Andrew Perez. The piece is titled, If Americans Can't Have Basic Things Like Childcare, Their Democracy is a Sham. In 2014, Northwestern and Princeton University researchers published a report statistically documenting how lawmakers do not listen or care about what most voters want, and instead mostly care about serving their big donors. Coupled with additional research documenting the discrepancy between donor and voter preferences, they bluntly concluded that the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. 7 years later, America is witnessing a very public and explicit illustration of this situation in real time. And the country seems pretty ticked off about it. In the lead-up to Tuesday, 2nd of November, off-year elections, and in advance of the upcoming midterm elections next year. Recently, Joe Biden and Democratic lawmakers have been making headlines agreeing to whittle down their social spending reconciliation bill at the demand of corporate donors and their congressional puppets. The specific initiatives being cut or watered down in the Biden agenda bill share two traits. One, they would require the wealthy and powerful to sacrifice a bit of their wealth and power. And two, they're quite literally the most popular proposals among rank-and-file voters. New polling demonstrates the silencing effect that systemic corruption is having on voter preferences. 82% of registered voters support adding dental and vision benefits to Medicare. And according to survey data from Morning Consult, this is voters' top priority for Democrats' social spending bill. Conservative Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona have pushed to keep these benefits out of the bill, following an aggressive lobbying campaign by health insurers who enjoy massive profits from the privatized Medicare Advantage program. According to Morning Consult, another top priority for voters is allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, with 72% saying they support the idea. Senator Kyrsten Sinema and a few House Democrats backed the pharmaceutical industry managed to block the party's original drug pricing measure from being put into the reconciliation bill. On Tuesday, 2nd of November, Democrats announced they had reached a deal on a drug pricing plan, which Politico, the website Politico, described as far weaker than Democrats' promised legislation. One industry analyst said the deal seems designed to let legislators claim an achievement while granting Big Pharma protection. The opinion poll also found that 70% of voters support including paid family and medical leave for new parents in Democrats' spending bill. Senator Joe Manchin has demanded that this item be cut. After raiding against the Republicans' 2017 tax law for years, Democrats have largely refused to raise taxes on corporations and the wealthy, and their final bill may even end up being a net tax cut for the rich. This, even though President Biden's own pollsters found that raising taxes on the wealthy was the most popular of more than 30 economic proposals they tested during the 2020 presidential campaign. The flip side of all this also appears to be true. Democrats have protected initiatives to enrich powerful corporations, even though some of those measures aren't very popular. One example, subsidies for health insurance plans purchased on the Affordable Care Act marketplace that shower money on for-profit insurers. Morning Consult reports that extending new Affordable Care Act premium tax credits passed by Democrats in March is the lowest ranking of all the health measures included in the poll. The results of this latest middle finger to voter preferences? New polling data shows that almost three-quarters of Americans now think the country is headed in the wrong direction. Taken together, this is the democracy crisis thrumming underneath all the media noise. The day-to-day erosion of democracy by corporations that use a system of legalized bribery to buy public policy, which then erodes Americans' faith in their government. And yet this erosion does not get discussed in a media-directed democracy discourse that focuses almost exclusively on the 6th of January insurrection or Republican efforts to deny election results and limit voting. This is what my 2006 book called The Hostile Takeover, the conquest of democratic institutions by money interests to the point where the world's greatest democracy routinely rejects the common sense policies that the vast majority of voters want and that every other high-income country has already adopted. Hostile takeover is not just the rejection of the most popular policies, it is also the media discourse itself. The Washington Press is constantly portraying industry-sponsored opponents of majoritarian policies as moderates or centrists, and depicting supporters of those policies as fringe lunatics who refuse to be reasonable and compromise. Meanwhile, there is a pervasive omerta that silences most media discussion of the corporate influence and corruption that so obviously defines American politics. And there is scant mention that the moderate obstructionists are bankrolled by the industry's lobbying to kill the popular policies that the American people want. There is some encouraging proof that more and more Americans innately understand the kleptocratic nature of this government and want explicit accountability journalism to uncover it. Also, mildly encouraging is the impact of that reporting in the reconciliation bill battle. Democrats tried to get rid of all the drug pricing provisions, but were successfully shamed into adding at least a few of the pathetically weak provisions back in after independent media aggressively exposed the big pharma ties of key lawmakers. It is not a huge victory and not worthy of some effusive celebration of Democrats because the provisions are watered down and a betrayal of the party's promise to do something a lot better. But it's a minimal proof of concept win. It may at least get the idea of Medicare negotiating drug prices into law for the first time. And as important, it shows that when there is a robust press willing to challenge power, the government can be forced, kicking and screaming, to respond, or at least pretend to respond. It's going to take a whole lot more of the kind of reporting and a whole lot more movement pressure to secure real wins and beat back the hostile takeover. The silver lining here is that at least the takeover is now explicit. The opinion polls show what people want compared to what being excised from the reconciliation bill makes this part of the democracy crisis impossible to deny. And ending that denial is a prerequisite for achieving something better.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, all big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, I'm your host Musa Al-Bahalili, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss issues, questions, and other relevant circumstances or topics parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself. Peace be upon them all. Joining us in our studio is our guest speaker and dear friend, Sayyid Abdullah Musul, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our session today is a continuation of the previous session's topics about how we should go on about understanding our children. Last we spoke about how important it is to recognize the traits that are most prevalent in our children and how we can use these to our advantage, and also how important it is to be patient. Lastly, we said that a child goes through different phases in their developing years. We said the first phase is when the child is just born until they get to 2 years of age. And we said that there are some characteristics that the parent must realize and understand to help the child develop. And we said, for example, that in this phase of their life, usually the child likes to be independent. They like to solely depend on themselves. They like to understand things by touch and so on and so forth. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. So previously we were talking about the fact that the parents need to understand the years of a child's life and what happens throughout each year because a child keeps changing.
Right.
And so we said that from 2 to 3, from the first 2 years, a child would have certain things which we mentioned previously. Now, for example, when a child is in his third year, he begins to ask a lot of questions. So about 10 to 15% of what the child talks about are in fact questions. And he might understand the answers, and if he pays attention, he might understand it if
right.
it is delivered to him in an easier way.
In a child-friendly manner.
Yeah, so you find a lot of children, for example, at this age, age of three, they start to ask a lot of questions. And most parents, for example, they either disregard the question of a child, or either they say there's something wrong with that child.
Or they get mad.
Or they say the child is, you know, he's very developed. Some people think that the children are extra smart because they're asking at this age. No, that's the age where the child begins to ask questions.
So they become curious at this age even
yeah.
more.
Yeah, so now is the time for them to learn things by right. asking, because now their vocabulary would have developed, their ability to communicate is much more, and now they can pass on questions. Now, obviously, when they ask questions based on their own understanding. So the question
right.
is simple. And sometimes they might give you a question that is extremely hard for you to answer as well.
Yeah, funnily enough, sometimes,
yeah.
They'll say they must interrupt you because we'll go on a quick break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the age of three and how in this phase of the children's lives they become curious a lot and they begin asking questions. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
So we said the child at this age, for example, he asks a lot of questions, he listens to the answers, sometimes he understands them, sometimes he doesn't, depending on how you give it to him, but nevertheless he listens. That's the thing. Right, I remember.
It's actually true. Always,
yeah. I remember one little child once asked me about who made God.
Right.
Now, I looked at him and I didn't know what to say to this child, so I had to, I don't know, bring an example with toys and robots to explain to him
right.
Who created God,
right?
Or if God is created to begin with. And
yeah.
then I met this child like years later. He was old enough. He was, I don't know, about in his 15, 16. And I said to him, remember you asked me that question? He's like, I remember I asked you the question, and I remember the answer that you gave
me. He remembers.
And I said, subhanAllah, see? So the child, even though he's very young, but the answer, you give him the answer, you might think that the child did not understand you. And true, maybe he didn't at that time.
Right.
But nevertheless, he listens. It stays with him. So you try to give him answers as much as you can without shutting him down, especially when it comes to questions of aqa'id.
Theological answers or beliefs.
Because this is the age where they ask a lot of these questions. Where God is, who God is, how did we come, where did the children come from, and stuff like that. And most parents...
they do something horribly stupid and they shut their children down. They say, you shouldn't ask such questions, or that is stupid to ask.
I think back in the day, parents used to do that a lot. They used to tell them, don't think about these kind of things. When you grow older, you'll know. But now, a child, even at 3 years old, he can navigate his way through Google. He can navigate his way through YouTube. He can navigate his way through, games and stuff like that. So they're not... Their brains are much more developed than our brains back in the day when we didn't have all these tools.
Right.
So back in the day, you might find a 10-year-old, 15-year-old, he does not know how to operate, for example, a VCR back in the day, with tapes. Yeah. But now you find a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, he can operate an iPad, an iPhone smoothly and flawlessly.
Right.
So that you can see that the gap has changed, the times have changed, people and children's brains and their activity also changed.
But not only that, if I might add, even if the child doesn't understand the answers provided, it encourages them to keep on being curious in pursuit of knowledge.
Yeah.
And that became a staple fact of the life, that they can always ask and receive a knowledge-based answer.
Exactly, exactly. So you don't want them to go ask this question to someone else and get the wrong answer from someone else.
Right,
so
that's also important. Yeah.
So you keep you keep the questions in the house.
A controlled environment.
Yeah, and you keep them asking all the time. So that's something natural to happen at the age of three.
Right.
Also, for example, at the age of three, a child is more defiant, and he has this concept of trying to go against the entire world from the age of three.
Already to at the age of three.
Yeah. So he's constantly. Arrogant, he's constantly not listening, he's constantly defining.
So they're small rebels, basically.
Yeah, so this also natural. Most parents, for example, this age, when they see their children from the age of 3 to age of 5, and they find their kids being very defiant, they take that as a way of a child being hatred, the child trying to, attack the parents, and so on and so forth.
Right. Dear Sayyid, we will go on a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, he who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
Welcome back to your listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are talking about the ages of 3 to 5 years old and how this phase is characterized by the child being a little rebel and being very defiant and also loving to be curious and asking questions. Dear Sayyid, please pick off where you left off. Thank you.
So when a child is at this age between 3 to 5 and he has this tendency to be more defiant towards his parents and towards people around him, we shouldn't take that as a sign of him trying to seek revenge or him trying to, be bad or hateful or resentment towards his parents. No, that's just a phase of his life he has to go through. So this is a time, through 3 to 5, where he just goes against everything, right? So
some say that this happens again in the teenager phase.
Yeah, it continues. Sometimes this kind of thing continues. If that's what we say, that's what we're trying to say, is very important for parents to understand that if the parents don't deal with it, based on what it is, it will continue. Because sometimes when a parent deals with a 4-year-old, 5-year-old child who is defiant, and they become defiant too,
right?
So the child is defiant. I'm becoming defiant. I'm increasing the problem.
Yeah.
But if the child has been defined, I need to be more flexible. So he kind of gives up. Yeah, right. De-escalate the situation, and he gives up this habit. The more parents increase their defiance with their children,
de-escalate the situation.
It grows with them. Right. Becomes, as we say, muhkam. It becomes very strong, embedded in them now.
Right.
So they become teenagers, and they're more defiant. Why? Because from a young age, you let it become part of them.
Right.
And instead of looking at it as a phase that a child goes through. So a child, we need to encourage that in a child. A child needs to be defiant in order for him to survive in the outside world.
Right.
It's a defense mechanism.
Because, funny enough, all these phases that you're mentioning about how the child is developing, some of these traits are like qualities and necessities of life if you want to be successful.
They are. So being defiant is a good thing for a child as he grows older. If it is, used correctly, if it's nurtured correctly, if it's the parents understand it for what it is, because like I said, most of the parents when they see their children at this age, I've seen many parents like they start to yell at the kids, they scream at the kids, hit them, punish them just for being defiant. It's just natural for them to be defiant. Just go with the flow. Deal with it based on what it is.
Be patient.
Right? Be patient. Try to work with them.
Right.
If you see the child being defiant in something, if it's something wrong, find a way to teach them, educate them, and try to absorb the problem and solve it in an easier, nicer manner. Not by going head-to-head with the child or just giving straightforward orders, don't do. He doesn't understand that yet. He doesn't understand these concepts yet. So it needs to be, taken into consideration.
Right.
And a child needs to work, a parent or an educator needs to work with a child in this regard. Now, a child goes, also from 3 to 6, for example. A child's mind is the sharpest, right? Children would remember things that happen at this age. So parents also need to be careful and mindful that what they do around a child and say around a child will stay in their heads.
They remember it. Yeah.
That's why even in Islam, for example, says when it comes to children, make sure that, you don't let them sleep in the same room, you don't let them see certain things, certain actions. Even the Quran talks about this kind of concept. Because children, these things, from 3 to 6, their minds are very sharp. They remember everything they hear and they remember everything that they see.
Right.
So what you do in front of a child from this age will stick with them. Right. Now, even me and you, that if we go back to this period of our life, you would find out that you remember a lot.
We have some memories.
Especially if things happen in the house. So sometimes outside events, because there's so many, you don't end up remembering too much. But events in the house, you find out that you remember them the most.
And on that thought-provoking note, we must end today's program. Dear Said, I thank you for your time today and for your insightful knowledge. And I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions, comments, or some feedback that they want to give us, they can find us at our website, parstoday.com, or they can write us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, they can also find us on our various social media accounts, under the call sign of Call of Islam Radio. Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in yet again.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.